Welcome back to Daughters of Mormonism for the second part of our panel discussion about depression. In this episode, we'll be discussing situational versus chemical depression, dreams, medication and depression, and therapy, among other things.
Let's talk a little bit about situational versus chemical depression, or is there another term other than chemical depression? Basically, I guess what I'm saying is depression that doesn't change when you change the situation. So that's what I'm talking about. That kind of unchanging depression, or I wish I had a good word for it, but situational versus non-situational depression. There we go.
Just using the terms that we hear. Maybe there's some researcher who can come along and give us some more nuanced terminology, but the terminology generally in use is situational and chemical depression.
Okay. So we're good.
I think so.
So for me, here's a little piece more of my story, I suppose, is that as I look back at it now, it was a very long situational depression, which was so long that I think that there were those around me who decided it was chemical, and they were telling me over and over that I needed to medicate it. But then when it turned into basically experiencing the trauma of all the things in the past kind of a thing, that was when I was able to move through it and work through it. And I'm no longer a depressive person, which is kind of amazing, like that I actually came out the other end of the tunnel. So I do believe that I'm not the only person in the world who has worked through what felt like everlasting, endless darkness kind of a thing to come out the other end. But I also believe that that's my story and not everyone's story. Like, I would never say, therefore, that means that everyone can work through it. Well, no. For me, it was years of excavating all of the pain. all of the pain from things that had happened to me as a child and as a teen. And digging through it layer by layer until I was finally able to heal those parts of my life. And that was a long space of work. But I did come out the other side. And also, this is very important, removing myself from the situations that would inflame those problems with me. So for instance, the church. I do not do well with the church. All of the messages that the church sends about how to be a good person, I did all of those exponentially, to the second power, to the third power, to the 12th power, however many powers you want to add on to that, I did them. And it never helped. It only dug me in deeper and deeper and deeper. So for me, the church does not offer help or hope when I was in that darkness. So moving out of Utah and distancing myself from the church has helped tremendously. Being able to resolve a lot of very difficult things from my past helped tremendously. And I now have a very different outlook on life. I feel that I'm very, like Lisa, when you were talking about seeing beauty and not being able to connect to it, I feel like I have become this very creative person who is strongly connected to the beauty all around me and so forth. Like I'm a different person than I was before. And my husband even has said to me before, I feel like you're not the same person that I married because of how much I worked through all of that darkness and came out on the other side. So for me, that was the journey, but that isn't always the case because for like Lisa, you've talked about with me about how this is a part of you that you have learned to embrace in different ways. I wonder if you would talk about that, because that was really inspiring to me when you told me about that.
Where to start? As we all know, the depression journey is long and complicated, and sometimes you don't really know where you're actually headed. But yeah, so I had my very chemical, not really going away depression forever. When I finally figured out what it was when I was about 21, I'm the kind of person that when I find out that there's a problem that I can do something about, I start doing something about it, which at the point I didn't know I was that kind of person. But so I started learning everything I could about depression, and I went to a bunch of counselors, and only a tiny fraction of them actually helped. And, you know, I prayed a lot about different ways to help me. Because, like I said, medication was really pushed on me, but it didn't feel right to me because my answer was going to be something else. So there came a pivotal time when I had a dream, which I won't tell you the whole thing because it's really long and very dreamy. But I was different aspects of myself, logical, emotional, and stuff like that. And the logic and emotion were actually physically trying to murder another piece of myself who was manifested as this gorgeous dark queen, just dressed all in black lace with a crown. And they were really trying to kill her, and she really wasn't dying. But when I woke up from it, I felt like I had been beating myself, because I had been. And I realized that this was my subconscious telling me something very, very important, that I was trying to kill a part of myself that I perceived as negative, but which wasn't necessarily negative for me. And as I talked through it with my sisters and the other people that were there to help me at the time, I kind of came to this space where I felt that it was about my depression, and that I had been trying everything I could to make it gone from me, but that it was a very valid and worthwhile part of what made me a whole person. And yeah, that's a different whole person than anybody else, but that wasn't wrong. So I started this very long journey to really understand how to embrace and accept my depression as a beautiful facet of who I was, and how to learn to walk in balance between that facet of myself and all the rest of them. And I'm still on that journey because, I mean, it's not easy. But I stopped being so afraid of the darkness that used to just eat me. Like, I used to just have days when I would just lay on my floor and just not be able to move, and I wouldn't get up to eat or anything. My bladder was the only thing that saved me from those episodes, because after a while, you just have to pee. So that actually got me to move. But when those really heavy blacknesses would come, instead of trying to fight them or distract myself with books or just detach and hope that it passed, I would, you know, get really scared, but then I would sit down and I would try to be there and like be conscious of the darkness. And as it descended on me, instead of, you know, curling up in a ball and wishing I was dead, I would feel it and I would try and go with it. And I would try to stay present as long as I could so that I could understand what it was I was feeling and doing and how I could use it and see the beauty in it and stuff like that. And, you know, it took years for that to go anywhere. But now I'm in a place where I'm very, very aware of my emotional states. And I'm in a very different place. And I'm not afraid of my darkness anymore. I've started to feel that my darkness is just as sacred a part of me as my light, and that I am a beautiful balance, and that my darkness enhances the beauty of who I am. And it doesn't take me over like it used to. Like, it's still definitely there, but not in such a bad and terrible way.
And you've created beautiful art where you've embraced that facet of yourself.
Yeah, art helped me, which was a surprise to me because I was never a quote-unquote artistic person. But yeah, when I was going through this journey, I bought some oil pastels, and that did really help me to have it visually there.
It's so interesting that this happened in that dream form for you, Lisa, because I've had that experience twice. Like, twice
really?
In my life, where I've had a dream that was so powerful that when I woke up, I knew it was speaking to my soul about what I needed to do.
Yeah.
And the first time, I made the mistake of not writing it down. When I woke up again, I went back to sleep. When I woke up again, I had kind of the sketchy outlines of it, mm-hmm. but I felt like I'd lost all this detail. And that one was pretty situational. It was about a very emotional situation I was in. The second time, I actually wrote it all down, and it was really clear to me that what I had dreamed was about my well-being and who I am, and being willing to kind of acknowledge and embrace it and do what I needed to do for me rather than pleasing other people or doing what other people thought I should do to take care of that problem, you know? Mm-hmm. And this second dream was specifically about my relationship with the church, because it happened at a time, and I talked about the Prop 8 thing when you and I first spoke, Sybil. I shared my story about that, and I had this dream at that time, and in this dream, my soul was this little feathered bird with a beautiful long tail and vicious claws, and I was in competition with my family. There was this big structure, and we each had a little part of the structure that we would pull out, and when it would land on your on my arm, it just tore flesh out. Like, got all bloody, it would tear my skin. And it was simultaneously beautiful and painful. And then one of my brothers took my part of that structure and moved it to repair the structure. And then I couldn't get at it anymore. So I couldn't participate anymore. And like this dream, I wrote it up. It's on the exponent, actually. And at the time I did it anonymously because like I was just too emotionally raw to be willing to own it publicly. And part of my journey in the last several years has been to get to a space where I am more willing to publicly own the fact that I'm essentially a disaffected Mormon, you know, that the church is not something that works for me in the way that it's presented. But this dream was a really pivotal part of that, like making me confront the fact that there was a part of me that needed to be free to go fly off in whatever direction would work to bring me spiritual peace. And since then, I've like gradually authorized myself to more and more publicly embrace that reality. Like 3 years ago, I would never have done a Sunstone paper for fear of the fact that my family might discover it, and then I'd have to confront that problem. You know, I would certainly never put my name on like anything that was too challenging of the church, and I do it now all the time. You know, it's like I've been on this journey of owning who I am and how I'm not what I've been told I should be, and how the methods of fixing my problems don't work for me, you know, and being willing to admit that and embrace that and live with it. Like, I had to get to a place where I could own who I am and live that reality. And I'm still not really good at it. I'm still figuring it out, you know, but I think that's been a really important part of my process of dealing with depression too, was just a willingness to kind of own and embrace the reality of my existence rather than trying to fit it into another form.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Dreams have been very helpful to me in my journey of finding myself in a healthy place. And yeah, I think if you're a person who has vivid dreams, you should pay attention because, yeah, they can lead you down paths you wouldn't really have considered and that are actually the healthiest ones for you. And yeah, like you said, living in denial, that's the worst thing you can do for depression. Like, you got to own up to all of yourself.
Yeah. And that's something I've read. So the single most helpful thing I've ever encountered for like just letting myself think about depression was, and I mentioned this in my interview with you earlier, Sybil, is the Krista Tippett, her show is now called On Being. It used to be called Speaking of Faith. She did an episode all about depression. Like, it's just such a revelatory, fascinating conversation she has with three different people. And part of what they were talking about was embracing this part of who you are and not trying to run away from it and not trying to defeat it. This is a part of your reality, and there are ways you can manage it. There are ways you can make it more productive. There are ways you can keep it from like controlling your life, but there is no way to eradicate it, you know? And I think that's one of those realities. It's a really scary reality, but that's one of the realities about depression. Changing the situation, it can make a radical difference in your life, you know, and can create a lot more happiness and peace and contentment. But that doesn't, like, it doesn't eradicate everything so fully that you're never going to have to deal with depression ever again. You know what I mean? It's not a miracle cure where you're just done with it forever.
I had hoped that I had found my miracle cure. So my depression disappeared. Like, I really felt like I had experienced some, you know, one of those like biblical miraculous healings when I joined the church. I went from atheist to LDS Christian. I was free from those years of, I don't know, abuse, whatever. But just those years of depression, I felt there was a period where I could say, you know, I can be free from this. And I was really kind of taken aback when I experienced another depressive episode a couple of years after joining the church. I was like, I thought I was free from it. Like, and it really took a little bit of integrating to realize that, like, I was maybe free from that particular time, but this is a new time that I have to deal with. And that's where I can identify with what you guys were speaking of earlier. You know, I thought like, oh, if I just keep reading my scriptures, if I keep going to the temple, and I did not understand why, as I did more of those things, I felt worse. It was really confusing at that time to go into the temple and feel like I was bringing something dark into the temple. I felt like I shouldn't be there. And that, you know, I thought maybe I could go for relief, and it just made it worse. And I was trying to understand how this could be possible, because it was so outside of my experience with the gospel. Because in the past, the gospel had been a comfort, a strength, a relief, a balm, all of those things that it promises to be. There's not a clear-cut answer. It's that lesson of you do what's important at the time, whether if you were observing outside looking in, thinking that it was the right thing to do, if it feels right, you have to go with that path. You have to take that little journey and figure out what that meaning is to you.
Kind of like what we were saying before about there isn't a one-size-fits-all cure or like a one-time get-out-of-jail-free card thing. It's like walking a tightrope. What works one second may have to be altered for the next second.
Yeah. You just have to go with what's right in the moment.
Yeah.
And kind of say, you know, be damned whoever's, you know, making assumptions and judgments on you.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, Jenny, one thing that is coming to mind as you're saying this is, okay, so have you seen the movie The Labyrinth with David Bowie?
Yes. Okay. I've been mistaken for Jennifer Connelly in the past.
Oh, yeah?
Nice.
Well, then maybe this will be especially meaningful.
I feel like some, you know, particular knowledge or expertise in this movie, shouldn't I?
So there's this moment that for me has come back to me at different points in my journey with this kind of archetypal power that just kind of, I don't know, kind of rocks things. And it's that moment where he is explaining to her, the Goblin King is explaining to Sarah that if she will just give herself over to him, then he will be her slave, right? And she looks at him and she blinks her eyes open like she's suddenly seeing what this is doing, like what this is that's happening and being offered to her right here. And she just says to him, "You have no power over me." And it's like she just realized it for the first time in her whole life. You have no power over me. And then, of course, that breaks the spell. And the Goblin King flies away into his flurry of wings and whatever. And she wakes up at home and everything's all right and whatever. But anyway, but the point being, there have been these moments in my journey where I looked at things that were supposed to be my helps that were actually my hinderers. Like you were saying, going to the temple obsessively or whatever wasn't helping. It was making things worse. I also went to the temple a whole lot during a certain period until I realized that every time I came back, it was darker and darker. Being able to look at those things that are held out to us as, here's the cure. And if you would just do it, then everything would be fine. Like I remember someone in my life telling me, from time to time, if you just got another calling, I'll bet you'd be happy again. I know, it's just, yeah, another calling would definitely help. Then I'd be that much more busy and have that much more to feel guilty about. You're right. No, but being able to look at that and say, you have no power over me. I am the one who is going to be making the decisions as I walk this labyrinth that makes perhaps no sense, but I will arrive where I arrive because of my choices, not because of yours. Did that make any sense?
Yes.
This is absolutely a great analogy for what I was trying to express a few minutes ago. So thank you for that.
You're welcome, Jennifer Connelly.
This is part of what can make depression so difficult for, at least for when I was kind of a more conventional Mormon than I am now. One of the things that makes it so difficult to deal with is you've been told all your life, it's the iron rod mentality, right? And there are lots of, there are interesting pieces out there that juxtapose iron rod Mormons against the Ahona Mormons. Mentality is that there is a way, and you adhere to that way, and as you adhere to that way, things are right and good. My experience dealing with depression and trying to work through it and trying to journey out of it into a place that was much more nourishing and peaceful and happy was that it wasn't about finding the way and going out of it that way. It was about recognizing that it wasn't about one way that fit everybody, that it was more exploratory. It was more embracing. It was more like recognizing that I was the one that had to be willing to make decisions and figure out which direction to go. And that there were a lot of places I could turn to for help as I did so, including things like the scriptures and prayer and people at church, but also including things that maybe people at church would never have suggested. And it was only when I kind of seized that and went with it that I was able to really find constructive helps for myself. And so that's a real challenge, I think, for a lot of people, because we do live in a society, not only in Mormon culture, but in a larger society, which has this very prescriptive mentality of there being a certain kind of life to live that signifies righteousness and goodness and happiness. And so you conform yourself to that way to live. And unfortunately, that doesn't do it for most people. A lot of people hide underneath their surface. They are hiding a lot of malcontent or unhappiness or depression or whatever.
Yeah, it's almost like it gives a space for things to fester.
Yeah.
Where if you could just open it up to the air, it may still be wounded, but it won't be infected.
Yeah.
So the thing that I'd like to kind of move on to is one of the things that's often offered as the cure, which is medication, which has, I think, a much more nuanced and complex space within depression than is commonly seen, because it's usually held out as take this pill and you're done. And there are those who choose to take medication and those who don't, and there's stigma attached to both sides. Whether you take medication, there's stigma attached to that. Oh, you have to take a pill to make it through your day, kind of a thing. And then if you don't take a pill, there's stigma attached to that. Well, you're not responsibly dealing with your depression. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there's stigma either way. And it's often offered as here's the way to get out of this pit you've fallen into, which is an inaccurate understanding as well. And so I'd like to hear what some of our different experiences have been with the question of medication and what our experience has been if we've taken it.
So I've kind of been off and on antidepressants for a long time, about 5 years, I guess. And the first go around, it didn't seem like it was helping all that much. So when I lost my insurance, I just kind of didn't really think about it and just let it go. And then 3 years ago, I went back to seeing a psychiatrist, and it was a huge roller coaster, because first of all, I was seeing, not interns, what do you call doctors when they're doing their kind of trial?
Residents.
Residents. Thank you. They were residents, so they were not really well experienced yet. And the kind of hip diagnosis right now is bipolar. That's not to say that people aren't actually bipolar. There are people out there who are actually bipolar, but it's become a very overdiagnosed problem. And so they diagnosed me as bipolar. And they started putting me on like all these different kinds of medicines. And I went from, like, I was so depressed I could not sleep. I would sleep like 2 or 3 hours every night. And on this medication, I ended up sleeping like 12 to 14 hours every night. Like, I remember driving to work one morning and like realizing as I was halfway to work, I should not be behind the wheel right now. This is dangerous. It was a little bit scary, like trying all these different kinds of medications, but at the same time, like nothing is right. Like it's kind of rare that the first thing you try is actually the right medication, you know? So you feel a little bit like a guinea pig. It really sucked. And it took a long time before we found a medication that really worked well. And it also took going to a more experienced psychiatrist who was willing to kind of like step back a little bit and reassess and, I don't know, just had the experience to look a little more clearly, I think, at what I was dealing with. But I was on the medication for a couple of years, and I was doing so, so much better that I talked to my doctor and I thought, you know, let's start kind of cutting this down to see how things go. And I did that for about 2 months, and I had enough of the kind of depressive symptoms that I dealt with, which a lot of my depression manifests in like not being able to make myself do what needed to be done, not being able to focus, not being able to like just effectively live my life, you know? And I started feeling a little out of control. And so I just thought, you know what? if I'm on this medication for the rest of my life, I don't care. Like, if it will help me be in a place where I'm like functioning well and I'm happy and I'm productive, then I'm going to just go ahead and go with it. So that's kind of where I am. I went back up to the dose I'd been at before, and I'm just like, for now, it's an open-ended thing. I plan on staying on my medication indefinite future, and I'm fine with that. You know, the thing that I think it's so important to realize is that if you try medication and you think that it is a good solution for you, if it is actually helping you cope and live more happily and more productively, it's not a magic solution, right? It's not like it gets you back to that space and then you can just cut it out overnight. And there are people who go off medications, but it has to be titrated down. So I had a good friend who did this, right? She got back to the point where she felt happy and productive and good. So she just stopped taking her antidepressants. And that's a really bad idea, you know? It's not something you can turn on and off really easily. I think it's, at the very least, you talk to your doctor.
I can definitely speak to that experience of just one day deciding that I didn't think it was helping very much and just going off of it and stopping it altogether. And after that, I did learn to do exactly what you were saying, to reduce the levels a little bit by a little bit and really wean myself off. But yeah, there were definite swings. Yeah. Where, and I, the thing that could make me most mad was when somebody said, did you go off your medication again?
Yeah.
And like, and I recognize how, you know, how true and how right they were in saying that, but it made me really angry because it made me feel like there was, you know, like I was dependent on it and that there's obviously something even more wrong with me because now I'm dependent on something.
There's, so in that On Being episode I talked about on depression, this guy's last name is Solomon, David Solomon, maybe? Anyway, he wrote a book called Noonday Demon, and it's a really, really well-respected book about the experience of depression. And he talks about encountering a friend one time and talking to her. He knew she'd dealt with depression and had been on medication, and he hadn't seen her for a long time. They got talking, and she said, well, I felt like my medication was making me not who I was. Like, I was too dependent on it. I was not myself anymore. So I went off my medication. But then my job was too stressful, so I took this other job, and it was too hard to maintain my relationship. So I ended the relationship, and, you know, I moved to a smaller house so I wouldn't have as much housekeeping. And his comment was, no, now you're not the person you were. You know, like, that medication had allowed you to live in a certain way. Like, his point was, you shouldn't feel guilty about dependency on medication. Diabetics don't feel guilty about dependence on medication. People with heart disease don't feel guilty about dependence on medication. People, like, there's all kinds of medical problems where you don't feel guilty about your dependence on a medication. And so I'm perfectly happy to acknowledge that for some people, medication is not the answer. But if you've discovered that medication is an answer for you and it does allow you to live productively and deal constructively with your depression, there shouldn't be shame and guilt associated with being, quote unquote, dependent on your medication. But our society makes us feel like there should be, you know? Like, somehow it's a flaw if you have to be dependent on medication. Like, as soon as it becomes about emotion and productivity and character, like, somehow you're a bad person if you're dependent on a substance to help you do that. You should be able to just do that on your own. And so I'm here to be the one who's going to really adamantly say no. Like, you should not be ashamed. If medication is what's going to help you, go for it. And anybody who tells you otherwise, tell them to go away. And that's, like I said, it's not to say that everybody should do medication, because I know lots of people who, for whom it wasn't the answer. But if you've found that it helps, don't get rid of it just because you feel like, in some kind of abstract sense, you shouldn't be dependent on medication.
Yeah,
I agree.
You're totally right. You're totally right. And, you know, I needed somebody to tell me that at the time.
I think the question of medication is really fascinating because it seems to be a fairly major facet. But I think that depression is a pretty multifaceted problem. Like, if you look at the speculation about what causes depression, I think that there's a mirror to that, to where, well, then, you know, healing from it or managing the symptoms of it would probably be multifaceted as well. because you're never sure if it's totally genetic or if it's partially genetic and partly situational, you know, and that kind of thing. And not to mention that depression runs into bipolar, which runs into OCD, which runs into trauma and PTSD. And so there's all this overlapping, not only of the causes, but also of your symptoms, and you might have other things going on. And so I would think that it's the least that we can do to be open to the idea that medication may work really well for someone and not so well for another person, and also that it's a personal choice.
Right. Well, and that's, Kendall, something you just said made me think about the fact that, like, sometimes medication might be a temporary thing, right? If you're in such a deep, dark, depressive state, medication might be something that raises you up out of that enough that you can then assess all the different facets and all the different facets of potential treatment and make a more balanced, informed decision about what kinds of treatment options might work for you. You know,
absolutely.
And, I mean, I know I have very good friends who they don't want to introduce chemicals into their body that are not strictly necessary. You know, so if they can use cognitive behavioral therapy or talk therapy or exercise and nutrition, or, you know, there's all kinds of things that can, that have been demonstrated to affect depression, to help, you know?
Well, and I think the standard response to if you are depressed is that you should consider therapy, and that usually the greatest success with dealing with depression is a combination of both. And so I think that that's really telling just in and of itself to say, you know, it's not one or the other, it's some combination, and who knows what it is for you, you need to figure that out.
Right. But the medication can be, if you're in a very dark, depressive, completely, like, incapacitated type depression, which it sounds like most of us have had some experience with, you know, that can be one tool to help you get to a place where you can better assess what your options are.
Absolutely.
That's why I think it's so important to not let ourselves stigmatize the medication, because even if your long-term approach has nothing to do with medication, it can be a useful tool in the short run.
Absolutely. And I've had situations like that, you know, in other areas of my life, but I also have, you know, a family member who has been depressed for a long time, you know, just sort of this low level, you know, this person's tried quite a few different approaches to dealing with it. And literally the only thing that's made a marked difference is probably like meditation in general and medication. And so what can we say at that point, you know, because I'm an advocate for, you know, avoiding medication if possible, but I'll take it, you know, if I need it, I'll take it, hands down.
This is really interesting because I think Lisa and I have not chosen that avenue in relation to depression. Am I right, Lisa?
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up with a mom who was on anxiety medication as long as I can remember. And she was always trying to reduce her dose, and then she'd get really bad, and so she'd up it again. And so I think from that experience, like, I think you're absolutely right that medication is a very useful tool in our arsenal of things we can do. But for me, it was a tool that I was highly uncomfortable with. So I did everything I could to find other ways because I didn't want to repeat my mother's pattern.
Yeah. And I also found that, I'm trying to remember how somebody said this, that back in the day, if someone was depressed, you took them to a psychologist who said, "What's wrong?" And now today, when someone's depressed, they take them to the doctor who says, "Here's a pill." But the point being that sometimes going in and digging around and finding out what is causing this can be a very, very good tool that I think is sometimes not considered as much in today's culture because of how we like to medicate everything from hyperactive children to prescribing antibiotics for viruses. And, you know, like we kind of medicate everything these days, it seems.
Well, I just had a thought that, you know, if we over-medicate, it sort of takes away the potency of the decision that we make when we do choose to medicate. And so it seems to be shooting us in the foot on either side. You know, we over-medicate, but the answer isn't really to never medicate. The answer is to responsibly medicate and to make the right decision, right? To where it's not like, oh, every single drug is bad because that's all we do nowadays. You know, we give our kids medicine for ADD and et cetera. It's just that, you know, I'd like it to actually work for the kids who really need it, you know, that we need to slow down and make an informed decision about it.
Right.
Yes. And that having the decision either to take medication or not to take medication to both have a space of validity. That is where I was trying to go to, Kendall. Thank you so much for that.
Because, yeah, I could feel it.
Oh, thank you. because yeah, it like Lisa, I definitely had different caring people in my life tell me at different points, you should be on medication. And my deepest instinct was telling me if I were to put antidepressants into my body with the kind of emotional work that I was working through as I faced these different issues, it would be like taking an archaeological dig that I had been working on for a decade and painstakingly moving down layer by layer and pouring concrete into it as a way to fix it and to understand it. And so for me, I needed to not put anything in there. I needed to only be taking things out because that was where my path lay. And it was hard to have people constantly tell me that that was a wrong choice. When years later, it turned out that for me, I was right. For me, that was the right choice. Like following what my own understanding of that labyrinth path was to lead me out to the other side, that for me, that meant not putting medication into the picture because it would have clouded things over. And I needed to see so clearly where I was digging.
There's been a third area of my life where I completely identify with that, and I've had to do the same thing. One of the results of me joining the church and feeling so strongly the way I do about, like, one of the things that attracted me to the church was the concept of the Mormon afterlife. And that became so real to me and such, like, a hope and, like, a yearning desire at, quite honestly, too young of an age that I struggled with feeling present and connected to this life. I had spent on and off, I think the first time I remember being suicidal, I was 7 years old. And it's still something that I will battle with every once in a while, where like something wrong will happen. And my first instinct is to have these very violent thoughts about hurting myself. And I now recognize that that's not my actual desire. It's just kind of how my thought processes have been shaped throughout my life, that it's almost instinctual now. Having to fight off this desire to move on from this world, I really had to connect. I had to find meaning in this world. And that required a lot of spiritual work and emotional work. And that's where I've been in the last 4 or 5 years, is doing some of that work. And I know, like, I wouldn't identify as depressed, but if you're fighting suicidality, you can pretty much say that that's a symptom of depression. And it's this idea of having, of being like what you're saying, or what you've said, Sybil, is finding beauty in the world around you and kind of clinging to those things and continuing to dig and understand. And I've really begun to understand that there is an unhealthy connection to the Mormon afterlife. And I've experienced it in my life, which is wanting to get there. So in that hope of, you know, knowledge and peace and rest and truth and all of those things, that I cannot just wait my life out until I'm old enough and my body stops working, that I can really find and explore some of those things that connect me to that truth, connect me to those people here while I'm still alive. And I can find hope and joy and, you know, excitement in that.
There's a couple things, Jenny, in response to what you're saying. And the question of medication, I think, so one of my friends was on an antidepressant and it made her too numb. You know, like it got rid of all the really bad lows, but it also meant that she wasn't connecting with her life, you know? And she said, well, it's really nice that I don't have to deal with the lows, but I can't live like this disconnect. And she went to a different, she actually solved that problem by trying a different medication, which kind of evened things out a little bit better for her, but allowed her to connect. But another option would be to use different kinds of therapies. But it's the idea of connection I want to get at, right? Because that's what you're talking about, is like being able to be in tune with the world around you, with your own emotional landscape, with the relationships that form your reality, you know? And that's what I heard you saying also, Sybil, was that one of the reasons that you decided not to use medication as a way to deal with this problem was because it felt like it wouldn't allow you to connect in a way that was vital.
Yeah.
Right. And that idea of connection has been like the most important thing for me to hold on to as I was dealing with depression. So when I was in the very worst places in my depression, it was hard for me to do this. I was in slightly, like still depressed, but slightly better. Like one of the things I would often do would, if I felt myself going down, like if I felt the darkness descending and going into a space that was difficult, I would make lists. And I would have to list one thing that I thought was beautiful or interesting or funny or whatever, one thing in my world and one thing about myself that were good and beautiful. And it was like this really kind of sounds silly, simple, like prescriptive way to make myself, force myself to reconnect.
Could you do it?
Not always.
I just remember so many times where that was impossible.
Yeah. And that's why I said when it was the darkest, like when I was in my darkest spaces, I couldn't do it. But when I was like on my way up and I would start feeling myself backsliding, when I had like reached a place that was better, but I'd feel that like starting to come back, this was one of the ways I would combat the darkness coming back, you know, the kind of debilitating darkness coming back would be to try to make myself connect with the world in some way. And Parker Palmer was one of the people interviewed on that show I've mentioned a couple times. And he talks about how people would say to him, Parker, why are you so sad? Just go outside. It's a beautiful day. And he talks about how useless that is, because when you're in the throes of depression, it is useless. There's just no amount of kind of objective knowledge that the world is beautiful is going to be able to jolt you out of it. So I don't want to say that, like, there's this simple thing that if only you'll go outside where it's sunny, or if only you'll look at the beauty of whatever, it's going to fix it. That's not true. And I think at later stages in the process, like consciously choosing to find something to connect to, whether it's a person or a thing or a place, that can be a really helpful thing, I think.
And I'll also, yeah. I feel like it's important to say it's okay to overshoot. Like when you find something that is working, it's going to seem like you have an excessive attachment to that thing for a while. And I really have just found that it has to be that way for that little while. And you can accept it and look at it and say, you know, I know this is how it is right now. And I know that, like, I'm kind of overdoing it. And I know that. But it's okay because I know I'm not always going to feel like I have to overdo it. It'll come back to a balance. It's not like you're going to just hit perfection every time you try, you find something that starts to work. You might have to overdo it for a while and then come back and find a homeostasis that works.
Thanks for listening to Daughters of Mormonism. To hear the next part of this panel, please go to daughtersofmormonism.blogspot.com. Special thanks to Sarah for editing this episode, and thanks to Kevin MacLeod for the music.